Welcome to a special audio report by our continuing medical education group, Research to Practice. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Recently, our group in Miami had the honor of presenting at the Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium in Orlando in January of 2007, a paper that was actually chosen as a plenary presentation at the meeting, and it was also presented at ASCO as a poster discussion. So after many years of interviewing people who had presented findings at meetings, I found myself in the unusual position of wanting to interview myself since we had presented something that, you know, at least had gained a fair amount of attention. So what we decided to do was instead just to kind of have me chat a little bit just directly to you rather than being interviewed about this really interesting project. And then after I sort of provide a little bit of background to you about what we did with this project, the program focuses on an interview I did with NSABP chair Dr. Norman Walmart to get his take on this interesting survey that we conducted of 150 people who'd receive adjuvant chemotherapy for colorectal cancer over the last 5 years. As always, when we try experiments and continuing education, we're really interested in your feedback. So let us know whether this sort of rambling beginning makes sense and whether it's helpful to you, particularly in leading into the interview with Dr. Walmart. This has really been a fascinating project that's been rolling out over the last few years, and it just keeps getting more and more interesting. We've really been looking at the whole issue of adjuvant systemic therapy for cancer of the colon and rectum, and particularly trying to get input from patients about what they've experienced, what their thoughts are, and see if we can come up with something to supplement the education they're receiving in the oncology office, as well as other sources, not the least of which is the internet. Adjuvant therapy obviously is a critical part of the practice of medical oncology, and actually based on our patterns of care studies, we think that adjuvant therapy of cancer of the colon, rectum, lung, and breast makes up about a third of office visits for medical oncology. So this is a very common clinical situation that physicians are chatting with patients about every day. And as every oncologist knows, this is not an easy thing to explain. The benefits of adjuvant therapy are kind of subtle to understand. As we all know, there's an improvement in the risk of relapse and survival that occurs with adjuvant therapy in all three of these tumors. But of course, it's not a black and white situation. And as a result, a lot of people receive therapy even though they're destined to relapse anyhow, or they don't need it in the first place because they're not going to relapse. So the whole issue of risks and benefits is very tricky with adjuvant therapy, you know, particularly because of the fact that the treatments that we use do have potentially significant side effects and complications. One of the things that spurred this current project in cancer of the colon and rectum was our patterns of care work, which showed kind of an interesting dichotomy between how oncologists in practice approach patients who have cancer of the colon and rectum as opposed to breast cancer. And what we've seen consistently for years is that if you look at the lower end of the spectrum, for example, node negative disease, both in colon and rectal cancer, you see that at the same risk of recurrence, an oncologist is much more likely to treat a woman with breast cancer than they would be to treat a patient with cancer of the colon or rectum. So if you present a case of a patient, for example, who's at a 10% risk of relapse or 20% risk of relapse, a patient with breast cancer is much more likely to receive systemic therapy. Now, we know part of the reason for that is clearly the clinical research data that's available addressing breast cancer in the node-negative situation is much greater than in colorectal cancer, and there's a lot more controversy about this in cancer of the colon and rectum. But we were also interested by the fact that if you look back over the last 20 years, one of the things that's shaped the culture of how we approach breast cancer has been a series of surveys that have been done of patients in terms of what their perspectives are. And I think the most well-known one was done in Australia in the 1980s, and it was considered so important that it was represented again at the 2000 NIH Consensus Conference on Early Breast Cancer. And basically what they did was ask 104 women who'd had CMF chemotherapy for breast cancer, how much of a benefit would you require in order to go through this therapy again? And out of that came the so-called 1% figure, a very famous figure that everybody in oncology is familiar with, specifically that a substantial number of these women said that they would be retreated with chemotherapy for as little as a 1% improvement in survival over a 5-year period. And we think that these kinds of surveys had a significant impact on oncologists making recommendations to patients with breast cancer because they were much more sensitized to the fact that people who have cancer maybe are a lot more interested in trying to reduce their risk of recurrence than we think they are and are willing to go through a lot more for very modest benefits. So our objective here was to ask the same kinds of questions, but also to get into some other issues in people who had received treatment for cancer of the colon or rectum. So in the first year of this project, we actually held a town meeting of more than 100 people who had a history of colon or rectal cancer and their relatives and their loved ones. We had a faculty there, and we just spent the whole day with them, chatting with them and letting them react to what we were chatting about using the keypads and computers. The second year of the project, which we reported at the so-called ASCO GI meeting in 2006, was a study we did of 150 people of all different stages and times of diagnosis of cancer of the colon and rectum. And we experimented a little bit with the issue of how to get information across to patients. We produced an audio program with Dr. John Marshall and for the first time got involved with asking them potential trade-off scenarios. The third year of the project, which is what we just reported at the ASCO GI meeting in Orlando, looked at 150 people specifically who'd received adjuvant therapy for cancer of the colon or rectum in the last 5 years. Now, one of the things we were really interested in was sort of trying to reproduce what was done with these breast cancer surveys, particularly the Australian study, and knowing that these people had gone through the experience of chemotherapy, and since they had firsthand information of what it was like, how much of a benefit would they have required to justify being treated with the same therapy again? And to do this, we put together a number of clinical scenarios. As any oncologist was familiar with these kinds of numbers, looking at what a baseline risk of recurrence would be, and then how that risk of recurrence would be altered by the use of chemotherapy, and specifically what the absolute benefit would be of treatment, and see whether or not that would be acceptable to a patient like this to be treated again. So, for example, we had a number of scenarios of higher risk situations where the baseline risk of relapse was 50%, and then it would decrease either, 1, 5, or 10% with therapy, and the question whether patients would want to be treated for that type of benefit. And then we also posed three scenarios with the baseline risk of recurrence of 20% and seeing whether reductions in the risk of 1, 3, and 5% off that 20% would be enough to have people treated. But prior to dealing with these scenarios, we had them listen to a 2-CD audio program that we produced that had investigators on it as well as patients who received adjuvant chemotherapy so that we could try to be as clear as possible with these patients what the current state of the art is about what we understand about the risks and benefits of therapy so that they could make some judgments about these trade-off situations. And in fact, as you can see in the report that accompanies this audio program, we actually put together these sort of little stick figures that specifically tried to document exactly what the impact would be so patients would know what the likelihood is that there would be a benefit and what the likelihood might be that the therapy wouldn't cause any significant change. So basically, we recruited these 150 people from across the country. We got them from advocacy groups, from physicians we had worked with, and we ended up with 150 people with a median age of 55. So they're a little bit younger than the average patient with cancer of the colon and rectum. Most of these people have been diagnosed with stage 3 disease and had colon cancer as opposed to rectal cancer. About 2/3 of the participants in the survey were women. 86% were Caucasian, and 79% had some college education. So like most surveys of this type, it wasn't completely typical of what we might see in a general population. And of course, we had to consider that when we interpreted the results. The other thing about the patients who participated in this survey is that about half of them had received an oxaliplatin-containing regimen, and half, probably those had been treated prior to when the MOSAIC data came out, received just a fluoropyrimidine. And another important feature about these 150 people was that most of them had not had a cancer recurrence at this point. In fact, about 87% are cancer-free at this point. So we had sort of a select group, clearly, that was taking the survey, but we were interested to see how these people would respond. One of the things that we asked them also is what they thought about the audio program they received, just to see whether they felt that they understood it. We know that the concepts behind adjuvant systemic therapy are pretty tricky and complex. But in fact, the patients told us that most of what we presented to them, the vast majority of it, they felt that they understood completely or almost completely. of related interest, incidentally, was the fact that they felt that this type of approach to education, a conversational approach that we've used with physicians for so many years, would be very useful to patients. And in fact, in this package that you've received, you'll see is a patient education program that we've produced based on this work. So let's talk a little bit about what we found in the survey, and then you'll hear what Dr. Wallmark thinks about it. Of course, the thing that we were most interested in was how they would react to these trade-off situations. And essentially, what we found was very similar to what was seen with the breast cancer patients. So, for example, about a third of these people said that they would be treated again with chemotherapy for as little as a 1% reduction in risk of relapse. So we saw that in cancer of the colon and rectum, just like in breast cancer, there was a significant fraction of people who were willing to go through therapy for what would seem to be a pretty modest improvement in outcome. But the other thing that we saw was that at the other end of the spectrum, 12% of the patients would not want to be treated again, even for a 10% absolute reduction in risk of recurrence. So 1 out of 10 chance that they could avoid recurrence, they wouldn't go through chemotherapy again. So I think that one graphic kind of goes almost a straight line up from 1% to 10% of the fraction of patients who would be willing to be treated again really tells a story of the heterogeneity and how people see these trade-offs. And importantly, the fact that there seems to be a significant fraction of patients, whether it's really a third or not, or maybe it's a little higher or lower, we don't know. It seems like there's a substantial number of people who'd be willing to be treated for a pretty modest improvement in outcome. Now, when people saw the survey data from the breast cancer patients, a lot of people interpreted this, well, this is a woman-man thing. Women are much more proactive about their health. They're willing to go through a lot more to stay healthy. And we were very interested to see whether there'd be any differences between men and women in this survey of colorectal cancer. And in fact, we found none. There was no difference in how they responded to these trade-offs. We also didn't see a significant difference whether or not they receive oxaliplatin or not. So even knowing that patients who'd receive oxaliplatin had exposure to the risk of increased side effects, they still had basically the same answers in terms of these trade-offs. And it's important to keep in mind that these are people who've actually been through the experience. As part of our Patterns of Care initiative, where we do national surveys of oncologists in practice as well as clinical investigators, we asked physicians to estimate what fraction of patients in general they think would be willing to go through therapy for these same 6 theoretical scenarios. And we found that their estimates were considerably lower than the way the patients responded. Now, whether they are more in tune to what the average patient thinks or not, compared to a patient who might take a survey like this, you know, it's hard to say. But for example, when you look at a 1% improvement in benefit, you see that about 35% of the patients said they would go through therapy again. Physicians thought that only about 18% of patients would actually be willing to go through therapy for this modest improvement in outcome. So there was a little bit of a discrepancy there that was kind of thought-provoking. The other thing that we asked the patients about was their experience with chemotherapy. And this is actually quite interesting. And the 7 patients that we interview on our audio program basically almost all told the exact same story, which was when they went into chemotherapy, they were expecting to have nausea, vomiting, and hair loss. And we're assuming that when they talked to their oncologist in the oncology office, that they were told, it's not too likely you're going to have these 2 problems with this specific type of therapy, and that they expected that to happen and were surprised when it didn't happen. And in fact, more than half of these patients felt that the nausea and vomiting or hair loss was, quote, not as bad as what they expected. So they were expecting it and it didn't happen. On the other hand, the experiences that they did have weren't quite exactly what they did expect. And for example, the patients who received oxaliplatin in general found that the issues with cold intolerance and peripheral neuropathy were a little bit worse than what they expected. At least about a third to a half of these people found that what they actually experienced in terms of these symptoms was worse than what they expected. And so putting it all together, our thought was that, first of all, these patients are probably getting information from other sources, other patients, or maybe friends or relatives who had chemotherapy, and perhaps hearing stories about other kinds of chemotherapy that perhaps are not completely relevant to receiving adjuvant therapy for cancer of the colon or rectum. In that regard, we asked these patients to provide A through F grades of their oncologists. And it was interesting, and we've also done this in breast cancer. we found that patients grade their medical oncologists generally very high, mostly A's and some B's. But when you start teasing out how they grade different aspects of the care they received, when you get to issues about providing information, for example, potential side effects of adjuvant chemotherapy, about a third gave their oncologists a C or worse in providing information. This also led us to think more about the idea of trying to supplement that. We know that patients are out on the web trying to get information, but that maybe we could provide some information that would be credible and useful to them to sort of satisfy the need they have or the need that some of these people have for more information. The other thing that we asked them about was participation in clinical research. And on the audio program, we talk about what clinical trials are in colorectal cancer, the kinds of studies that are out there so they can understand what was involved. And what we found, and this is not the first time this has been seen, is that most of these people were not offered participation in a clinical trial. And of the patients who weren't offered participation, the vast majority or more than three quarters of these people would have liked to receive information on clinical trial participation. So how do we put this whole thing together? One conclusion that we came to was that it's not that easy to understand what a person who's diagnosed with cancer is going through and how they see their lives, how they see the cancer, how they see the potential treatment. Even for oncologists, people who are taking care of patients with cancer every day, to be able to understand the concerns that these people have and the focus that they have is a challenge for all of us. And a lot of people found these data surprising. I mean, this ended up in USA Today, for example. It's fascinating to think that somebody would go through chemotherapy for a 1% reduction in the chance of remaining free of cancer. But patients tell us over and over, and particularly interesting patients who are also physicians, that you just don't understand, you know, what it's like to be in this situation. I think this survey is another reminder of the fact that people who are diagnosed with cancer are in an unusual space, and we have to try to understand where they are and meet their needs individually. Clearly, the findings as it relates to trade-offs are very interesting, but I think we also have to take into consideration the fact that this study does have limitations. We know that patients or people who participate in surveys like this are more likely to be doing well. As you can see, most of these people are free of recurrence. The education level is higher than the average patient. The age is younger. So we know that this may not be typical of the overall population of patients who are treated. But our goal here was not really to do a definitive scientific behavioral science study, but rather just to stimulate thought and really to gather some input that we can use in our education platforms, such as this one right now, where we're reporting this data to you. Another thing that we thought was interesting from the point of view of the physician in practice is the information we found out about what people expected about chemotherapy and then experienced. We find this to be maybe a helpful reminder that people are getting information from all different kinds of sources, including other patients, and a lot of this information may not be relevant. So that perhaps it's worthwhile to talk to people about what their expectations are, what their knowledge level is, who are entering this experience, and perhaps try to head off some of the concerns that people have, not all of which really may be justified. However, if you really take a step back at this whole project, we think the message that comes through is the fact that there's an opportunity here to help these patients by providing supplemental information. And that's why we designed this pilot education program to see whether or not we can come up with something that is going to be useful to patients. And specifically, what we're going to be doing on the next phase of this project is to take this patient education program that we've developed and evaluate it with people who are actually going through the process of being diagnosed with cancer of the colon or rectum, having adjuvant chemotherapy recommended, and then going through the experience. And that's what we're going to be doing this year as part of this project. But to get another take on what we learned here, I met with Dr. Norman Walmark in Orlando the day we presented these data. I love talking to Norm about these controversial issues. He tells it like it is. And he's been a big supporter of this project since the beginning. And he's always kind of got a little bit of a thorn in his side about the differences in how people approach breast and colon cancer. Of course, the NSABP, those are the two tumors that they focus on. And Norm always gets irritated by the fact that breast cancer seems to be ahead of colorectal cancer. And I think part of the reason he wanted to sit down with me to chat about this is to be able to verbalize his thoughts about this controversial issue.
The whole rationale for adjuvant therapy is to give that patient a better opportunity to be cured. One of the stimuli for adjuvant therapy in breast cancer was the realization in the early NSABP trials of B04 that operative nuance is not likely to result in significant change relative to outcome and cure rates, and that the reason that patients fail is not because of inattention to operative detail, but that they have microscopic occult metastases at the time of the operation. And that adjuvant therapy, either in the form and breast of hormonal therapy or chemotherapy, lowers the likelihood of developing metastatic disease at a later point following the operation. So this was the basic premise and rationale and hope for the first trials in adjuvant therapy, which in the modern era were started in 1972, NSABP protocol B05, the Milan CMF studies, which all showed proof of principle that you can prolong disease-free survival and cure rate of therapy. The rationale for colon is identical. As a matter of fact, you know, the whole retreat from the radical operation occurred in a similar kind of evolution as it did in breast. It just took longer, I think, for surgeons to embrace adjuvant therapy with the same degree of enthusiasm in colon as it did in breast. And there, too, the demonstrations early on that the use of adjuvant chemotherapy in colon cancer can prolong disease-free survival and ultimately overall survival, I think, was clearly demonstrated in the 90s the same way as it had in breast cancer.
So today we see that both in colon and breast cancer that adjuvant therapy is frequently utilized. And yet there's a little bit of a discrepancy in terms of how physicians approach patients with breast and colon cancer, specifically that oncologists are more likely to utilize adjuvant systemic therapy, including chemotherapy, in breast cancer than they are in colon cancer in the lower risk situation. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of what you think it means?
I think it underscores a disconnect. It underscores, you know, a heterogeneity, an inconsistency amongst oncologists, primarily. It's not an inconsistency in the benefit and responsiveness of the tumor of breast cancer as opposed to colon cancer. The philosophy of medical oncologists specializing in breast cancer is somewhat different than it is in the philosophy of an individual treating colon cancer. So I guess focusing in on the point, what does the patient want? What is the patient's desire? And there we also see the disconnect, because what I think we've been doing on behalf of the patient really does not reflect that patient's desire in this particular situation. Because as I think you have shown, and you've shown preliminarily with the data that you reported in 2005, and now what you're reporting at this meeting, is that patients respond in a similar fashion, whether they have breast cancer or colon cancer, to a similar risk. And even with a 1% risk, you have shown that over a third of these patients or in that range in both breast and colon would be willing to go through adjuvant chemotherapy. So I think in the process, we've really lost sight of what the patient's desire is and have really taken the imprimatur to act on their behalf without having that information. So I think that this is a very probing analysis of areas that we have taken for granted.
I guess one of the things that people bring up about the issue of breast versus colon in the lower risk node negative situation, stage 2 colon cancer, is that, quote, there's not as much supporting data to support using therapy in that situation in colon as there is in breast. What do you think about those statements?
There may not be as much in the number of patients treated. On the other hand, I think that there's consistency in stating that there's no reason to think that biologically a low-risk colon cancer is going to respond or benefit in a different manner than a stage 3 colon cancer. Similarly, you can make that statement for stage 1 and 2 breast cancer. And yet, we haven't been inhibited by the threshold that it takes to give chemotherapy in breast, whereas we have been inhibited by the threshold that it takes to use chemotherapy in colon. I do want to clarify something. I'm not suggesting that every patient who has a stage 2 colon cancer should receive chemotherapy. It may be that the majority should not. But I think that the patient has to be an integral part of that decision-making process. I think the patient should be given an opportunity to participate in determining whether or not he or she is going to get chemotherapy. And right now, I think your data have shown very clearly that we have underestimated the desire of a patient with stage 2 colon cancer to proceed with chemotherapy, even chemotherapy containing oxaliplatin.
Now, the philosophy that you just described of allowing the patient to be involved in the decision if they want really is what happened in breast cancer. As you say, it wasn't like, well, we need to treat people. It was that we need to inform them. So do you think that essentially most people or all people with stage 2 colon cancer, assuming they're, you know, reasonably healthy, should be made aware of this as a possibility or only, say, patients who are, quote, higher risk?
No, I think they all should be made aware. And I think that, you know, here we're going back to, well, we really don't have to talk about this because I don't think that it's worthwhile. I think that we ought to talk about it. I think that shouldn't prevent a physician saying, you know, I personally don't think that it would be in your best interest to do that, because I think we all have an obligation to our patients to give them that advice, and I think they want to have that advice from us. But on the other hand, they should have the data in the eventuality that they don't agree with our bias.
I wonder, too, how challenging it is to get into the mindset of someone who's just been diagnosed with breast or colon cancer facing a possible recurrence. And even if you are an oncologist who takes care of patients all the time, if you can really understand how sort of their mindset sort of changes and why they might want to get chemotherapy for 1% reduction in relapse rate.
Right. And I'm not sure that we have to really analyze what's going through their minds. I think we have to assure ourselves that they understand the information that we're presenting. And I think that your diagrams, I think, make it unequivocally clear what the benefit is with your little event icons. So it becomes very clear the number that benefit, the number that don't benefit. And you've depicted it very graphically. So I think individuals who are going to be in a position to have to make that decision and still deciding to go ahead with chemotherapy understand that the number of patients who are going to benefit is small. And yet, with those graphics, and you even went back and asked them whether they understood what it is that they had been told, and the answer was yes. So in spite of that, we still see that a significant proportion, even for 1% absolute benefit, and that's for high-risk 1% benefit or low-risk benefit, still would have elected to go forward with adjuvant chemotherapy in the form of oxaliplatin.
There's another interesting thing, too, also at the other end of the spectrum, which is that when we presented a scenario where there was a 10% reduction in absolute chance of having a recurrence, even though the majority of patients, you think about it, this is a 1 in 10 chance that you're going to avoid having an untreatable cancer relapse, still, there were 12% of people who wouldn't want to get chemotherapy in that situation. I guess that's the other side of involving patients in these decisions.
Absolutely. I think it's highly likely that that individual who, after being informed, even for 10%, decides not to go ahead and have chemotherapy, I think one has to respect that. It's not likely that a medical oncologist could have said to that individual, I'm going to go ahead and treat you with chemotherapy. The likelihood is they would have said no in any case. But I think that this information is very useful.
And you're avoiding 1 out of 10. Most people value that. But it's still not an all or none hypothesis.
But not everybody values
Absolutely.
It. And one has to be sensitive to
right,
that.
Right. The other thing that I was really looking forward to when we did this study was to see what the difference was between men and women. Because, you know, there have been really no studies like this in colon cancer and a bunch of them in breast. And I think that some people kind of came away with these kinds of surveys. You remember the Australian study that started all this in 1986 when they did this?
This is Alan Coates.
Yeah, Symes and Coates, right. And they represented that again at the 2000 Consensus Conference. Was that, you know, was this a female-male thing? Are we looking at proactive women with breast cancer? Or is this really a cancer thing that anybody, male or female, facing a cancer recurrence, you know, has a similar mindset? And we actually looked at this, and we really didn't see any difference between men and women.
I was struck by that. I wasn't surprised by it, but certainly I think this is data rather than speculation. And there does not appear to be a whole lot of difference between the response or preference of men and women. There didn't seem to be any disparate preference relative to age in a very big way that I could determine. And I think that's all very comforting and supportive that this is meaningful information.
I thought it was also interesting. And, you know, we actually tried to reproduce sort of what Symes and Coates said, in that these were people who'd had adjuvant chemotherapy. And we said, okay, you've been through it. You know what it was like to get the kind that you got. Would you go through it again? Or do you think it'd be worth it for these benefits?
Or would you recommend it?
Right. And one of the things also that we saw was there wasn't a whole lot of difference. About half these people had had oxaliplatin, which of course brings additional side effects and toxicity potentially. And again, we didn't see much of a difference whether they had oxali or not, kind of suggests that quality of life maybe wasn't that much different, you know, in those patients compared to the others. But at least their perception of trade-off seems to be about the same.
Yes.
Any thoughts about that?
I would have expected that there would have been a difference, and yet there wasn't. So, again, I think we have to listen.
Well, that also gets into the fact that we surveyed 150 randomly selected medical oncologists, and we were able to find about 24 researchers in GI cancer. And we asked them to try to predict. I gave them the same exact scenarios we gave to the patients, and we said, what fraction of patients do you think would want to be treated in this situation? Now, of course, they're talking about all the patients that they might see in their practice, the kinds of people who might have come into this type of survey. Maybe they were younger. But in any event, their predictions were a lot lower than what the patients said. What were your thoughts about that?
I wasn't surprised. But there's a consistent trend here that regardless as to whether we have medical oncologists or clinical investigators, they underestimate the desire of their patients to proceed with chemotherapy. And you showed this in your previous study, and I think that you've shown it again here.
The other thing that we found in this survey that was kind of interesting and unexpected was we asked the patients who'd had adjuvant chemotherapy, what was the experience like compared to what they expected?
Right. I found that interesting.
It was, and it was interesting because, you know, we interviewed 7 patients and actually a couple spouses for our audio program. And I started to hear a consistent story in these interviews, and it was actually reflected in the survey, which was they said, well, yeah, they told me that I wasn't going to have nausea, vomiting, and hair loss. But then I talked to my Aunt Nellie, who got, quote, chemotherapy, and she got really sick, and, you know, she lost all her hair. Or my friend got chemotherapy. And in fact, more than half of the patients went into this expecting to have nausea, vomiting, hair loss, and then were surprised when it didn't happen.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very useful information. I think it's also useful information that one can share with patients in whom we're contemplating chemotherapy as a tool to really put these percentages into proportion and tell them this is what other patients who have received chemotherapy thought of the toxicity, and that we overestimated the impact of nausea and vomiting, just as you point out here, and hair loss, underestimated the neurotoxicity, where they thought that the neurotoxicity was worse than what they had expected. And that's very useful information, particularly to patients who are faced with the prospect of making the decision as to whether to go forward with it.
And, you know, my hypothesis, too, and we want to look at this now that we've seen this, is that maybe Aunt Nellie didn't get, she might have gotten AC for breast cancer, which doesn't have neurotoxicity. So there's maybe a lot of information, maybe even in the oncologist's waiting room, that's getting transferred around that the patients are receiving.
Well, we can talk about neurotoxicity, grade 3, 8%. What does that actually mean? And having feedback from patients who've gone through the same regimen, I think could be very helpful to the patient. By the same token, the nausea and vomiting proportion, the fact that medical oncologists tended to overestimate it as far as the severity and impact on the patient, having a group of individuals who've gone through it and their opinion was that it was not as bad as what they had been given to believe is also useful information.
The other thing that kind of ties into this is that we asked these patients to grade using an A through F system the care that they receive from their medical oncologist. And of course, again, you know, maybe the types of people who participate in the survey are or are not representative of people in practice. But we did see an interesting trend, which is when we asked them to provide grades about sort of the overall care, did the oncologist care about you as a person? Did they spend time with you? Did they allow questions? 90% or more of the oncologists were given A's or B's. But when we asked specifically about providing information, we saw a subset, maybe of about a quarter of these patients, who really weren't too happy with the information they were getting. They gave the docs a C or worse. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the fact that the vast majority gave them high marks overall, I think, is very important. So the next issue becomes a matter of how do we fine-tune this so that we can really get, you know, the additional information to them in a meaningful manner. I think the fact that, by and large, patients were happy and gave high marks to the medical oncologist is very gratifying. You know, it's not surprising, but when we hear some of the reports as to how well we're doing, particularly from entities outside the medical profession, this is very reassuring to have objective information. Now it's a matter of how can we make the information more meaningful, knowing that it's coming from individuals who are respected, who are considered to be effective individuals and good doctors.
But I wonder whether or not, and again, we want to sort of look into this, whether oncologists and physicians in general dealing with cancer patients maybe underestimate how much competing information is coming into that patient, particularly through the internet, through talking to people, through talking to other patients, and that maybe, you know, there are this subset of people, maybe it's these people who are getting huge volumes of information who want more out of their oncologists.
Perhaps it's not a matter of more out of their oncologists, but more accurate information or information that can be more applicable to their individual situation. I think it's that nuance that we're talking about here, because I think it indicates that they respect their physicians as capable individuals. And I think that we all want that. I think the medical oncologists want this just as much as the patients. Medical oncologists want their patients to be informed. And I think this discloses areas where we can both do better.
Patients obviously are tremendously interested in, you know, what kinds of side effects they might be experiencing with therapy. And one of the things that an oncologist can't tell them is what it's really like to go through
right,
this.
Right, precisely.
But we were wondering, and we've actually gotten a good response to oncologists about the idea of the oncologist saying, you know, here's an audio CD or here's a website that you can go to and you can listen to a bunch of people tell their stories about what happened in
right.
terms of that and maybe give another source of information.
Or even these kinds of graphs. I mean, just looking at them to say that the patients thought that the information they heard overestimated how they actually felt
right.
relative to nausea and vomiting. And the reverse was true relative to neurotoxicity.
Right.
Very useful.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is what the patient said to us about participation in clinical trials, because it was quite interesting. And again, I think that maybe the types of people who came into this survey might have been a little bit more proactive than the, quote, average patient. So I don't know that these numbers exactly apply. But there are a couple of interesting things. The first thing is that most of these patients did not get information about participating in clinical trials. Of course, they had listened to our audio program where we talked about what clinical trials were. They might not have heard about it before. But of the people who didn't get information, 80% said, I would have liked to have had information about that. Any thoughts about that?
It underscores the fact that the vast majority of patients are not apprised of clinical trials as an option. Were you offered participation in a clinical trial as part of your treatment? 60% said no. And I'm sure this is a survey of individuals, physicians, who are very much conversant with clinical trials. So the vast majority still are not offered clinical trials. or not offered the option or information about existing clinical trials.
Do you think that's something that patients should be proactive about and say, are you participating in trials? Are there any that I might enter?
I think they should be, but I think we also have to counter that by realizing that, you know, the great hope that there would be resources available to increase the participation of individuals in clinical trials as a result of initiatives from the NCI has really taken an unfortunate turn. Clinical trials are time-consuming. I think that medical oncologists who participate in clinical trials have to do so with an altruistic intent, believing that the state of the art is going to be benefited by their participation. And we're really not providing the resources and the support to make that something that the medical oncologist can do in a practical fashion. The amount of effort, time, paperwork, the logistic labyrinth that's required to participate in clinical trials, which is ever increasing, and a shrinking budget makes this a very daunting task. So, I mean, do we blame the medical oncologist that 60% weren't given information relative to clinical trials? I certainly don't. I think that the great hope that clinical trials would be incorporated as a standard as a result of the initiatives of the NCI just has not occurred.
You know, the other thing that we talk about in the education program about clinical research is the fact that certainly we're trying to move the field forward. We're trying to help future patients. We know that's what's motivating a lot of patients to participate. But there's also the possibility that a patient might end up receiving a therapy that actually could be helpful specifically to them. Is the most recent dramatic example that the adjuvant trastuzumab studies that fortunately turned out to be very positive in breast cancer. And yet these women who participate in the study not only help move the field forward, but many of them actually ended up avoiding having cancer relapse as a result of being in that trial. And certainly we can't promise that to patients, but that is an opportunity, including in colorectal cancer.
Yes, it is. And, you know, it's not something that we should come to expect. I mean, it raises enormous hopes, and I think that the trastuzumabs are few and far between. What we can say to patients, I think, in a very candid way, is if they participate in a clinical trial, they will be getting the highest standard of care, a highest standard of care which is mandated prospectively by the protocol document. And I sincerely believe that the level of care within a clinical trial is better than the average level of care that is delivered outside a clinical trial. And certainly that's one thing we can assure a patient of. And also the fact that they're participating in a clinical trial will further the state of the art, even if we have an intervention that is considerably less of a hurrah than trastuzumab, as undoubtedly most of them will be.
There was one other thing that we saw in terms of research that I thought was really interesting, which was of the patients who were offered participation in clinical trials, only a fraction actually decided to move forward with participation, which I guess brings up this whole issue of really informing the patient and allowing them to decide whether they really want to be in the study.
Precisely. I mean, what concerns me is that 60% weren't even given the opportunity to discuss clinical trials or weren't given information relative to clinical trials. You have to respect the wishes of the patient. If the patient says, no, I don't think this clinical trial is for me, I'm not comfortable with the fact that my therapy is going to be decided at random, you can try and inform that patient that therapy selected at random isn't necessarily, you know, therapy that's going to put them at a disadvantage, quite the contrary. But at the end, you have to respect the wishes of the individual.
And when you say random, you're talking about the very common type of trial where there'll be two different therapies, maybe very similar, and the patient will be, quote, randomized to one of the two sort of by the computer.
Precisely. And some patients are just not comfortable with that, to say, I want the doctor to select. And, you know, as much as you can say that from a scientific process, there's bias involved and so on and so forth, you still have to respect the patient's wishes that they're not comfortable with that. Then there are going to be a proportion of patients who are not going to be. On the other hand, I would like to see them arrive at that conclusion after being informed of the opportunity of clinical trials rather than not being given the opportunity to participate. I mean, there's one anecdote that I will always remember. We had a panel of individuals, of patients who'd participated in NSABP trials, and we asked them, why did you participate? And one individual who was a nurse came out with something that was poignant. And she said, you know, the concern that I've heard expressed over and over about therapy being selected at random. She said, before I heard about NSABP protocol, I went to 6 medical oncologists and got 6 different recommendations for the treatment of my disease. Says, here I see the document. It's limited to 2 or 3 options. She says, you want random, you go out there and you pull 8 or 9 medical oncologists and you'll see what random is.
And that's exactly what we see in our patterns of care studies. We present typical situations and almost any tumor, I mean, some more than others, and just as you say, you'll find 25% of oncologists to do one thing, 25%. And so theoretically, you go to 4 people, you have a 1 in 4 chance you're going to get one of those 4 things. I think we should point out that a lot of times the difference between what's being recommended is not necessarily huge, although sometimes it is, but nuances that, again, the trials are trying to tease apart.
Right, and all these recommended therapies are all based on information, and they're all therapies that I think are effective, and yet they differ from one oncologist to the next.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to all the patients who participated in this program and the investigators who assisted us, as well as Dr. Walmark. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special report on patient perspectives in adjuvant systemic therapy of early colorectal cancer.